Remember in John 10, verse 18, when Jesus made the remark, he said, I laid my life down only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down and the authority to take it up again. That is a profound concept. And next week, in Easter, we, along with all the other churches, are going to focus on the fact that Jesus had the authority to take his life back up from the grave again. Which is an amazing thing. That's the whole principle about around which everything is based. But have you ever thought much about the fact that Jesus also said, I have the authority to lay my life down? That's what we're going to look at this morning. Jesus' authority to lay down his life. Very often, in the time approaching Easter, we speak about the crucifixion, and very often we speak about the crucifixion in dark, tragic, sad terms. In fact, there are some churches that will have a Good Friday service right before Easter, and they'll have a deal where they go in there and they talk about the crucifixion and the tragedy of it and the sadness and the horror of it, and then everybody walks out in dead silence, in sadness. Have you ever been in a church like that? Have you ever experienced that? And that there's nothing wrong with that. That can be a very powerful thing. Because viewed from the human perspective, the cross was a terrible tragedy. I mean, it's the blight on mankind. It's the worst sin imaginable, killing the Son of God. A horrible thing. But that's not the only way to look at it. You know, each gospel writer, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all wrote the things that they wrote in the way that they wrote, and they included the things they included because each one of them had a specific purpose, a specific way they were trying to present Christ. All four of them true, but different angles. And John, when you get to John, he wrote his gospel with this in mind. He wanted to present Jesus as God. Now, it's crystal clear in the other gospels that Jesus was fully human as well. But John wants to emphasize the fact that Jesus is 100% almighty God. Not partially God, not a God, not one of many gods, but the creator God, the eternal creator God. And so that's his purpose. And so he skips over the parts that illustrate Jesus' humanity and his humiliation and his weakness and just focuses in on his deity. And so if you can imagine John writing his gospel, and then he gets to the end of the story, he gets to the crucifixion. What's John going to do with the crucifixion? How is he going to use that? You might think, well, man, maybe he'll just skip over it, go right to the resurrection if he wants to illustrate Jesus' power and his divine nature. But if we think that, we don't fully understand the crucifixion. There's no way John is about to skip the crucifixion. Because the cross is an ideal prime opportunity to emphasize Jesus' majesty and his glory and his deity. And that's what we're going to look at in John 18. So John chapter 18, we'll divide this up into segments. First, the surrender. Verse 1. When Jesus finished praying, he left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. And that's kind of an interesting image, just going from the temple down a steep bank, going eastward into this Kidron Valley with this brook, and stepping over the brook. The reason I think that would be interesting is because this is at the Passover time. And at the Passover time, there's 250,000 lambs that were being slain right up on top of that hill. And they cut a channel for all that blood of 250,000 lambs to come down and drain out through the Kidron Valley. And so what a powerful moment, if you can imagine, Jesus stepping across this little brook and seeing the blood flowing across, all this blood from lambs whose death illustrated the very blood that he would shed the next day. Well, anyway, he goes across the Kidron Valley, and it says on the other side there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went up to it. So they go over the valley, and then they go up into this hill, and there's a garden up there, the Garden of Gethsemane, and an olive grove, and they go up into that garden. And that's it. That is, he's had it now. Jesus is His life is done now, because he just, by going into that olive grove, he sealed his fate. He put the nail in the coffin. That's it. You say, what? What? He goes into a garden? What? Why did that cost him his life? Why is his fate sealed? Because he went into a garden. Well, let me just give you a little background. And this is just fascinating, the way this unfolds here. When Jesus was a baby, there was an attempt on his life. Herod the Great tried to kill him with all of his army, tried to kill this little baby and failed. Which is amazing, because Herod the Great rarely failed when he tried to kill somebody, but he failed in this case. And then Jesus, we see him when he preaches his very first sermon in his hometown, they drag him out to the outskirts of the city, and they're going to throw him off a cliff and stone him to death. They're going to kill him, and they try to do that, but Jesus, he just walks away. He just walks away. Another failed attempt on his life, because it's not time yet. And in John chapter 5, Jewish leaders decide to kill Jesus, and they fail. And then he claims to be God, and so they step up their efforts. They fail again. Then in John chapter 7, you know, their attempts to kill Jesus became so obvious that the people in John chapter 7, verse 25, this is some of the point people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man they're trying to kill? And he's out here in the open? I mean, everyone knew it. There's no question. They tried to arrest him in that chapter. They failed. The next chapter, John 8, they try and kill him again. And Jesus said, my hour has not yet come. No, you cannot kill me. And they failed. In John chapter 10, verse 30, it says they picked up stones to stone him. Now they have the stones in their hands, ready to stone him. Another failed attempt. It's not time. John chapter 11, the next chapter, verse 53, the chief priest plotted to take his life, but they couldn't because his time hadn't come. Nothing could happen outside of Jesus' perfect timing. And finally, John chapter 12, verse 23, finally, Jesus says this, the hour has come. And if you turn to Matthew 26, I want to show you how this came about. Matthew chapter 26, and in verse 2 of that chapter, Jesus makes this incredible announcement to his disciples. He says, 2 more days and the chief priests will kill me. 2 days and I'll be dead. Now, this is 2 days before the Passover day. So he says, 2 days and they're going to put me to death, the chief priests. And then the scene flashes across town, and suddenly in the very next verse, in verse 3, we're all across town, and we're in a meeting with the chief priests. And they are angry. They have had more of Jesus than they can possibly stand. He has intimidated them beyond their ability to endure it. In verse 3, they start having their meeting, and they plot to kill Jesus in verse 4. But look at verse 5. They said, we're going to kill him, but verse 5, but not during the feast. Or there might be a riot. Millions of Jews have flocked to Jerusalem. Jesus is very popular at this moment. And they say, we don't want to riot, so not during the feast. We're going to kill him. They've been trying to kill him for years. They wanted to kill him anytime. Anytime is a great time to kill Jesus for them, except now. Not now. Not during the feast. You say, how long is the feast? Well, it starts with the day of Passover in 2 days, and then it goes for another week after that. So they're saying, not for at least 10 more days. Jesus said, nope, 2. 2. Right on the day of Passover itself. When Jesus says the hour has come, the hour has come. And you better believe it's going to happen because nobody takes his life from him. He has the authority to lay it down on his own accord. But nobody could kill Jesus without him allowing it. It was this date, on this year, the year he was killed, on Friday, the 14th of Nisan, between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that Jesus Christ, before the foundation of the world, determined this would be the hour. And you say, well, how did that come to be? I mean, they don't want to do it. God says it's going to happen. How does God sovereignly control and cause something to happen when the people don't even want to do it? He doesn't override their free will. I mean, these people just choose to do whatever they want. That's crystal clear as we read. So how does God do this? Well, skip down to verse 16 in Matthew 26. And we're going to see his sovereignty in action here. Look at verse 16. It says, from then on, Judas looked for an opportunity to hand him over. Judas is looking for an opportunity. You say, what kind of opportunity? Judas is looking for a time when he's alone, away from the crowd, so they won't have this riot. And so he's watching for it. Now look at what happens the very next verse. He's looking for an opportunity, and then look what happens in verse 17. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus to say, where do you want us to make preparations to eat the Passover meal? Oh, perfect! I mean, Judas' ears perk up, and he says, oh, that's ideal. The Passover meal, there won't be any crowds. Just a group of just over 10 people and not more than 20, and this is going to be great. We can have the soldiers meet us there, and this is going to be perfect. And you can just imagine Judas moving over a little closer to here, pretending he's not interested, you know, and trying to get an idea of where this thing's going to be. Look at Jesus' answer. Next verse, verse 18, Jesus gives the answer. He says to the disciples, and by the way, in Luke 22:8, it says, he said this only to Peter and John. He says to Peter and John, you two guys, go into the city to a certain man. A certain man. And that's really funny in the Greek. It's the idea is a nondescript person. Mr. So-and-so, you could translate. So Jesus says, Judas standing right there. Okay, you guys, go in and talk to Mr. So-and-so in town. And tell him, the teacher says, my appointed time is near. We're going to eat at your house. Oh, brother. Judas, can you imagine his disappointment? I mean, this is funny. All this secrecy. It's like something out of a 007, you know, spy movie or something. Go into town, talk to Mr. So-and-so, and tell him the the teacher is ready. You know, and all this code language and secret language. And Jesus is just, you know what? Listen, everything's going to progress according to Jesus' timetable, not Judas, not the chief priests. So it doesn't work out. They go and Jesus tells them how to find the guy. He's going to be carrying water and everything. So they find him. They get into his upper room there. And Judas never has a chance to be too obvious if he left after they get there and then comes back with soldiers. And so there they all are in the upper room eating. Judas is there and he's still waiting. And all Judas can think about the whole time is just, when am I going to get another opportunity? And Jesus is washing his feet. And he's sitting there thinking, when can I get another chance to turn him over? Well, finally, Jesus dismisses Judas. He says, okay, Judas, go ahead. What you're going to do, do it quickly. Go. And Judas leaves. And so now, and then Jesus does a few more things, and then they close in prayer. And then they leave the upper room. And so that's where John picks it up. So now go back to John 18. John picks it up in verse 1 of chapter 18, right when Jesus closes in prayer. It says, when he finished praying, in verse 1, he went with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side is Olive Grove. He and his disciples went into it. And now, verse 2, Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. He keeps on saying, with his disciples. That becomes important in a minute. You'll see why. But he goes into the garden, and verse 3 tells us why. Verse 2 tells us why. He went into the garden because Judas knew that he always went into that garden. He had established a pattern every night of going to that garden. And then, when he knows Judas is looking for an opportunity, and the time has come, Jesus goes right to the place that he knew would be the very first place Judas would look. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. By going into this garden, Jesus is voluntarily surrendering his life. They had no power over him. Everything about Jesus' death was voluntary in every way. He was not trapped. He was not tricked. He was not surprised. He gave up his own life. Well, at this point, Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us the whole story about Jesus' anguish in the garden. And they talk about him praying. And we see Jesus here at his weakest. I mean, he's depressed. He's troubled. He says, my soul is overwhelmed to sorrow to the point of death. He says, I feel like I'm going to die. I'm so upset. He repeatedly is falling down on his face in the dirt. And then the hematidrosis, the hemorrhage into the sweat glands of blood, and the extreme emotional distress, and the prayer, the crying out to God, calling it reduced to speaking like a child. Daddy, he says, I don't want to drink this cup. If there's any other way, please let me not have to drink of this cup of suffering. The disciples keep falling asleep. And then Matthew tells us about the last time when Jesus comes, the last time and wakes them up. And he says this, you don't turn there, I'll just read it, Matthew 26:45. It says, he returned to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! Look, the hour is near. Rise and let us go. Here comes my betrayer. And while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. And now here comes the arrest. Jesus is going to be arrested at this point. And here's where John picks up the story. He skips over all that stuff about Jesus' weakness and his humanity, but he wants to pick up on the arrest. You say, why? If John is skipping over the things that are humiliating and demeaning and debasing to Christ, I mean, what's more humiliating than being arrested and led away and bound? Well, you'll see. Look at verse 3. Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers. A detachment, a cohort. You know what that word means? It means 600 soldiers. 600. Isn't that kind of a lot? Well, yeah, but that's not unusual. Rome often would send large numbers of soldiers for an arrest, especially one like this, where there's a... You have to understand, when Rome heard the word Messiah, that meant one thing to them, and that is insurrectionists. And Rome dealt very decisively with insurrections. They crushed them. I mean, they just overwhelmed them and smashed them. Any kind of insurrection against Rome. And so it's no wonder that they would bring this many. Plus, we find from Mark 14:51 that they were coming not just to arrest Jesus. They were coming to arrest Jesus and the 11 apostles and the others that were some others with them as well. And they're supposed to arrest the whole bunch. And if you come up in the middle of the night, a whole bunch of guys, and then they just scatter in every direction, you're going to need a pretty good sized force to round them all up. Right? So they come with 600. And then it says, not just the detachment of soldiers, but also some officials from the chief priests. That's the temple guard. That's the Jewish police force. And Pharisees and their servants, and they were carrying torches and lanterns. It's interesting. Historians tell us that this took place on the night of a full moon. They wouldn't really have needed torches and lanterns for the walk up there. Evidently, what was happening is they brought all these lights and lamps and torches and everything because they thought they were going to have to search for Jesus. They thought they were going to be all hiding behind rocks and trees and everything in the garden. They're going to have to search them out. Well, they didn't just have torches and lanterns. They also had weapons. And Matthew tells us that they had swords and clubs. Romans would have had the swords, the Jewish police force, the clubs, and apparently there were some other people conscripted just at the last minute, just grabbed whatever weapon they could grab. These are the weapons of the day. You have to understand, this is their weaponry that they had. I mean, this, if you translate this into our day, it would be like saying, okay, there was a detachment of the from the military, and they're coming up with M16 machine guns, and the police force was there, and they were armed, and then there's a bunch of people with baseball bats and tire irons. I mean, that's the image that John is painting here. And here they come up the hill. And this is a group of men approaching 1,000 men. Can you imagine the scene? I mean, this is amazing. Here they come with their swords and clubs to arrest the Prince of Peace. Here they come with all their lanterns and torches to seek out the light of the world. Now imagine you're one of the disciples. Imagine you're there and you're laying on the ground and you're asleep. And suddenly Jesus is shaking you and waking you up and he says, enough sleeping. Here, look, here they come. And you say, what? And you look at Jesus, and immediately you know something's wrong. You've never seen him like this. His face is covered with dirt and sweat and blood, and his clothes are soaked and dirty, and he's upset beyond anything you've ever seen. And you, wow, you look, and you can't believe your eyes. You get up on one shoulder, and you look, and here comes up the hill 1,000 men with torches and swords, armed to the teeth, coming to get you. And you panic, you say, what should I do? Should I run? Can I hide somewhere here? Can I get away? And maybe I should just stay with Jesus. Maybe that's the safe thing, but I don't know. Look at him. I mean, I've never seen him like this. Maybe this is too much for him. Maybe even he's being overwhelmed by this. I mean, maybe this is the end. What should I do? Well, then we see the interrogation. You know, there's often, when there's an arrest, very often there's an interrogation that takes place. And that's what happens. But this one's a little different. Verse 4. John says, Jesus, knowing all that was about to happen, and you know John's going to throw that in. He can't let one verse get by without reminding you that you're talking about God here. Knowing everything that was going to happen, Jesus went out. He approached them. He's not slinking back behind some olive tree somewhere. He approaches them, he walks right up to them, and he demands an answer. Who are you speaking? I mean, he just gets right in their face, and he demands that they respond to him. He interrogates them. Who do you want? He's an absolute command of this whole scene, right from the very beginning, and he never lets it go. Verse 5, they answer. Jesus of Nazareth, they reply. I don't know how that strikes you. That kind of sounds to me like they're just reading right off the arrest warrant or something. I mean, they knew Jesus. Judas at this point had already kissed him, even though that was totally useless in a waste, because Jesus made it useless because he revealed himself. I mean, he just steps right out in light. They've got lanterns. They've got torches. It's a full moon. They can see him. He's often been in the temple. Judas has done his thing. It was crystal clear who Jesus was. He's standing right there. All they have to say is, who are we after? We're after you. We're here to arrest you. But they're faced with Jesus' incredible authority, and it kind of cows them, and so says here, Jesus of Nazareth, not you, is this, you know, and Jesus responds, and, you know, you want to understand why the disciples had to be there? Why John makes a big deal about that? Look at Jesus' response. Jesus of Nazareth, he says, and then just like thunder, the awesome voice of Christ just comes out, I am. And when Jesus, and John says, and by the way, Judas the traitor is standing with them. He makes it real clear. He wants this clear in your mind, this picture. He's not with the disciples. He's over there with this crowd. Why? Well, look at what happens in the next verse. Verse 6, when Jesus said, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, can you imagine that? They drew back. That, in the Greek, that's a very interesting term. It means suddenly they were occupying the space right behind them. That's what it's. And then it says they fell to the ground. So they just blasted them all over. They're just flat on their backs. Can you imagine this scene? 1,000 men. Talk about being slain in the spirit. This is it. Wham! Now what happened? I was reading one commentary this week and he said evidently what happened is the people in front were a little startled at Jesus coming at them and they just bumped, you know, the guys behind them and then just like dominoes, they all went down. Please, listen. What kind of a comic book explanation is that? This is not a cartoon. This really happened. These are Roman soldiers, the greatest fighting force in the world at that time. They're not idiots standing there 1 inch behind each other with their knees locked, looking around. I mean, this is a miracle. Jesus, with two words, flattened a Roman cohort and the entire Jewish police force and the Sanhedrin and their servants. See why the disciples had to be there? If Jesus went to the garden alone, they would have been safe, yes, but then when they heard about it, secondhand, oh, they captured Jesus, they would have saw him as a victim, their faith would have gone down the tubes, very likely. No, Jesus, they had to be there so they could see this happen. Jesus at his weakest. This is Jesus at his weakest. If Jesus at his weakest can flatten a Roman army, imagine what he's like now that he's exalted to the right hand of God. Well, he gives an absolutely monumental display of power here. And he shows that he's capable of doing everything that they wanted the Messiah to do. With a word, crush Rome. But then he proceeds after that to give himself up to arrest. Why? He wanted to demonstrate the truth of his words. No one takes his life from him. He gives it up on his own accord. He has the authority to lay it down. Verse 7. He asked them again. He let them get up. If you can just picture the scene. I mean, Jesus says, I am. There they all, 1,000 men lying flat on their backs. And if they're coming up the hill, then they're at an angle, you know, in a slant laying downhill. And then these 11 guys and Jesus standing upright, just standing looking at them all laying there. So Jesus stands there and waits patiently while they all scramble and get back up on their feet. And then he asks them the same question again. Who are you seeking? And you imagine what it's like for those soldiers? Can you imagine? I mean, just picture that you're one of them. You're there, and you're armed, and your adrenaline is pumping, and you're ready for a battle, you're ready for a fight, and you've got your swords and everything, you're coming up with a torch, and all of a sudden Jesus says two words, and wham! Now you're looking at the stars, and you're thinking, what happened? I don't know what they were thinking. I'll tell you what they weren't thinking, is that somebody tipped over in front, you know, and then, you know, I know. Well, anyway, Jesus asks them again. He says, who are you seeking? And look at what they say. Jesus of Nazareth. Verse 7. The same answer. What blocks? I mean, what morons are these? What blindness this is? After he just demonstrated that much power, what should they have done? I mean, I would have thought they'd get up and he'd say, okay, now who do you think? And I'd say, nobody. Our mistake. Sorry, we're just out for March. No, they just keep right on going. It doesn't even faze them. You know, that's the way unbelief is. That's the nature of unbelief. You show somebody who has hardened unbelief the awesome display, incredible display of Jesus' great power, and they just ignore it and go right on their business. It happens today. The only rational explanation for everything that's going around them is that God is in control of it, and they just refuse to accept that. They ignore it. Because the only rational answer is an answer they're not willing to accept. And that's the nature of unbelief. Just refuse to believe regardless of the evidence. Martin Luther said, heaven and earth could be created right in front of people like this and it wouldn't affect them. And before we wear out our fingers pointing at them, look at yourself. How many times has Christ flattened you because of some sin and then you got up and kept right on going? In that same sense. Well, verse 8. Jesus gives the same answer. He says, I told you, I am. And this time he lets him remain standing. It would have been kind of fun, I think, if they had kept falling every single time he spoke, but it was just a one-time thing. And I mentioned before from Mark, we know that they came to arrest not only Jesus, but all that were with him. And let me ask you a question. How many did they arrest? None. I mean, Jesus, but how many of the apostles? Zero. Zero. A cohort of Roman soldiers and the Jewish police force, and they get none. Now, how did that happen? Well, look at verse 8. Jesus just twice got them to say, Jesus of Nazareth, and now he says this. Okay, if you're looking for me, then let these men go. And in the Greek, that is an aorist imperative. It is the strongest command possible in the Greek language. This is not a plea. This is not a request. This is a strongly worded ultimatum, an order, a direct order. Let them go. Look who's giving orders here. This is some scene. How does a Galilean carpenter, unarmed, give orders to a Roman cohort and powerful politicians and angry enemies? Well, easy. You get them to read the first part of the arrest warrant, and as soon as they get to Jesus of Nazareth, flatten them on their back so they can't finish. Well, he says, you're ordered to let these men go. And when he said, let these men go, he said that with the same infinite authority in his voice that he had all those times when he commanded the demons and to come out, and instantly they obeyed. That same authority in Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, when he commanded the devil himself to leave, and bam, he left. And he instantly obeyed. The same authority that was in his voice when he commanded the wind and the waves to stop, and instantly they stopped. That same infinite authority that he had in his voice when he commanded death itself to release somebody, and they came back to life. And with that authority, he says, let these men go. This is the same voice that at one time spoke and the universe sprang into existence out of nothing. Anytime Jesus wanted to, he could speak with this kind of authority and buckle the knees of anybody. In fact, in the next chapter, chapter 19, you see him strike fear even into the heart of Pilate at the trial. So, Jesus makes it crystal clear to these soldiers that it would be very dangerous and very perilous for them to try and go beyond the bounds of what he allows. He said, you can arrest me, you can arrest no one else, and that's it. Verse 9. This happened so that the words that he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have lost not one of those you gave me. And we don't really have time to go into that. It's a fascinating prophecy. Jesus said he would lose none. And when he said that, it's very clear that he was speaking in spiritual terms. He wouldn't lose them spiritually. Now he applies it to they won't be arrested. And the implication is, if they were arrested at this moment, it would be too much for them spiritually to handle. They wouldn't be able to handle it. And they would fall spiritually. And so Jesus won't allow it. Later, they would be, after the resurrection, after they witnessed the resurrection, they'd be emboldened. They'd be able to handle suffering. They'd be able to handle being arrested and thrown in prison and tortured and killed. But not now. They're just not capable of that now. And so Jesus won't allow them to be tested that far. And he says, no, you can't touch them. Beautiful picture of his protection. So they don't get any of them. Imagine the commander of this cohort going back to Pilate or whoever he reported to, his superior. One, where are the rest of them? Don't you know their arrest warrant said to arrest them all? Where are they? Don't you know that if you don't follow a direct order that could cost you your life, why didn't you arrest the rest of them? Why didn't you arrest all his followers? Because he said we couldn't. He said we weren't allowed. He wouldn't let us. I don't know how that went over, but at this point, they make their advance to go, and they start, okay, Jesus made it clear, just me, and so they start approaching Jesus to bind him and to take him away and to arrest him. And at this point, the disciples panic. Luke 22:49 says, when Jesus' followers saw what was about to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? They only had two swords. Peter had one. I don't know who, maybe James or John had the other one. But they said, should we fight here? What's going on? And John 10, look at verse 18, look at verse 10. Peter doesn't bother to ask or to wait for an answer. He had a sword. He drew it, and he struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. And the servant's name was Malchus. Just throw that in. But anyway, his name was Malchus. Peter approaches this guy and whack, attacks. And immediately you hear the sickening sound of 1,000 swords being drawn out of their scabbards. What happened next would have all happened very, very quickly. So let's just freeze the frame here for just a second so that we can take a look at this scene so we can understand it. You've heard that Peter was impetuous. You know, there's impetuous, and then there's this. Peter takes out his sword and attacks the Roman army. This is Peter. I mean, this is not David. This is not one of the mighty men of valor. He's probably never been in a sword fight. It's just like one of you or me. And these are trained killers. Now, this whole thing is just going to escalate. And listen, I don't know what Peter was thinking. Maybe Peter was just emboldened because of what Jesus just did. You know, maybe he figures, well, I'll just start plowing through them, and if I get into trouble, I'll Jesus just say I am again, and I'll be fine, and I'll go down. But, you know, he strikes at Malchus and cut off his ear. And now, you know, Peter's not a surgeon. He wasn't going for his ear. He's trying to cut off his head. Malchus, you know, the guy's got reaction. He ducked. And Peter just caught his ear. And the ear just ends in the dirt. The language says it was completely cut off. It wasn't just injured. So, there's the ear there in the dirt. And you can imagine what would have happened right after that. This is a real problem. Now, at first glance, we read that and we're kind of pleased at that. I mean, that Peter did that. I don't know how you feel, but at least one blow was struck in defense of Christ. But you know, this isn't a good thing. This is a real problem. Because Jesus has to die an innocent man. You understand that? That is so crucial. If his group resists arrest and they get into a fight, Rome has a case against Jesus. A legitimate case. Jesus had this whole thing under control. And now, within seconds, this thing is just going to escalate. Peter, first of all, has committed a crime. Second of all, Peter has started a fight. And the only conceivable outcome to this is bloodshed. And the ruin, the total ruin of everything Christ was about to accomplish. Peter would be dead. The other disciples would either be dead or in prison. And you can forget about Pilate ever saying to Jesus, I find no fault with this man. And you can forget about Jesus' statement later on in verse 36 when he talks about his disciples haven't resisted and haven't fought. If Jesus dies an insurrectionist rather than the spotless Lamb of God, you can just write off the whole atonement. He has to die an innocent man. So right here during this freeze frame, it appears that everything is lost. Because God allows this free will deal, and people just act on their own decisions and cause problems. There's no way to retrieve this situation. The deed's already been done. The crime's already been committed. It can't be undone. Or can it? If we unfreeze the frame and let it go, this all happens very quickly. If you just imagine it. Peter, they say, Lord, they're approaching the Lord, they're going to arrest him, and the disciples say, Lord, should we attack? And Peter doesn't wait for an answer, he draws a sword, and he tries for Malchus' head, and he just goes right up to the very front thing, and a very prestigious, important person, and whack, he chops off his ear. All of a sudden, 1,000 swords come out of their scabbard, they advance, in a couple of seconds, there's going to be a major fight, and then suddenly Jesus, with all the authority that he had in his voice last time, speaks again. In a couple seconds, Peter's about to be dead, but Jesus speaks up in verse 51 of Luke 22, and Jesus says, in his almighty, omnipotent, divine authority, says, no more of this. Stop. And it says he touched the man's ear and healed him. Jesus picked this guy's ear up off the ground and just put it back on his head. Now that's amazing. That's another miracle. But you know the incredible thing about that isn't so much the miracle as much as the love. Why was Malchus there? He was assisting. He was there to try and help murder Jesus. And Jesus healed his ear. He didn't have to do that. He could have stuck that ear to his forehead or he could have done anything, you know. He heals his ear and makes it the way it was before. Can you imagine the kindness? This is his enemy trying to kill him. And Jesus is touching his head. I'm sorry, you know, this is Peter. I can't take him anywhere. He's just the way.
And he heals him.
Well, Jesus literally undid Peter's crime. See how he's protecting Peter? How are they ever going to prosecute Peter for this? I mean, you men are charged with cutting this man's ear off last night. The judge, what? You know, his ear looks fine to me. Well, that's just because Jesus put it back on. You know, in order to see what Jesus does, he makes it so that in order for them to prosecute Peter for doing this, they have to admit to a miracle. And they don't want to do that, so they're just going to drop it. The sea never leaves Christ's omnipotent control. He's still in total command. Verse 11, he commands to Peter, put your sword away. And then Matthew 26 tells us that he also said, don't you know that I can call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? A legion is 6,000. Don't you know there's 72,000 giant angels with their swords drawn, ready, just listening for the word? Ready to annihilate this group? Peter, I don't think I need your little sword. Don't you understand that? But then he says this. But then, and that must have been very comforting to the disciples, 12 legions. That's one for Jesus and a whole legion for each disciple. But verse 54 in that chapter, he says, but then how would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? John 18, and look at verse 11. He says, and shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? The cross was not some unfortunate crisis perpetrated on a helpless Christ. The cross was a cup that he willingly drank. In fact, he had to go out of his way to keep his disciples from fouling it up. No one takes his life. He has the authority to lay it down on his own accord. What's the cup? You say, what is that cup? What's he talking about? That's the cup of suffering. That's the cup of God's wrath. That's the cup that he just got done praying. Lord, Father, please let this cup pass from me. I don't want to drink it. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. And the Father says, this is the only way. And so Jesus submits to that and says, I'll drink it. That is the cup of God's wrath over sin. That is the cup of God's wrath and anger over our sin. That's our cup. That's the cup we should be drinking for all of eternity. He willingly took it for us. Somebody said, death and the curse were in that cup. O Christ, 'twas full for thee, but thou hast drained the last dark dregs. 'Tis empty now for me. There's no wrath left in it. For those who are in Christ, there's no wrath left. You understand that? Those of you who think that God is angry at you all the time, if you are in Christ, there's no wrath left in that cup for you to drink. Jesus drank it all. He willingly submitted to it. Well, verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with his commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus, and they bound him and took him away. You know, there's two sides to the crucifixion. There's that ugly human side. Matthew 26, 16 says Judas delivered Jesus over. He betrayed Jesus. And the word betray means to deliver over. Judas delivered him over. In John 19, 16 it says Pilate delivered him over. But did you know in Romans 8, verse 32, it says God did not spare his own son but delivered him over for us all. The same word. God, there's another side to the crucifixion. And in Ephesians 5, 2, it says Christ loved us and delivered himself up for us. He betrayed himself for us. In Acts 2:32, it says, Jesus of Nazareth was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. From the human perspective, the cross was ugly. It was wicked men pounding nails through the flesh of Christ. But from the divine perspective, it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. It's God's set purpose and foreknowledge, what he planned. Crucifixion is like some magical glass, and you can look through it, and you look through one side, and you see the perverse, depraved ugliness of the black wickedness of man's worst sin. But then you can turn it around and look through it, And then from that side, you can see into the glory, the wondrous beauty of the most wonderful act of love God ever did. There's two sides. You know, the cross, what is the cross? It's wicked men putting Jesus to death by nailing him to a cross. But it's also God the Father handing over his Son willingly according to his own set purpose and foreknowledge. It was the greatest act of cruelty ever perpetrated by mankind, and it was the greatest act of love ever conceived in the heart of God. It was man at his most wicked, it was God at his most merciful. It was at once the epitome of human sin and the pinnacle of God's goodness. This passage teaches us what it means to be safe in Christ. You know, we talk a lot about being saved, but what about another way to look at it is to be safe in Christ. You know, I remember one time I was walking, I was thinking about this week, I was walking through a neighborhood looking for a kite that my brother and I had lost, my big brother, and a big, huge bully came around the corner. This guy was a terrifying guy, and he terrorized me all the time. And here he comes around the corner, and the first thing I did was I jumped behind my big brother, who really wasn't much help, because this guy's a lot bigger than him, too. But you know, these disciples standing behind Christ in that scene are totally safe. You get behind Christ and you are safe. What a scene that is in the garden. I'd love to have a painting of it, a big, great painting. I mean, the imagery of all of the hostility of the world coming up the hill, and then there you are with a few others huddled in total helplessness and fear, and in between stands Christ. And you jump behind him and you are safe. He will allow difficulties, he'll allow struggles, he'll allow testing and trials and problems. But if anything or anyone ever just steps, tries to step one inch beyond the bounds of his perfect plan for you, that's it. He stops it. He will not allow it to happen. 1 Corinthians, remember, you cannot be tempted beyond your ability. He won't ever, ever let it happen. You're safe in him. Even when your life seems like a total chaos, you stand behind the incomparable Christ and you're safe. No matter what it looks like, you can be assured that in every detail of your life, he has under full control. There is no chaos. Even when the odds against you are 1,000 to 1, you stand with Christ and he will issue the incontestable, compulsory command, let him go. Don't touch her. She's mine. And at that word, all the demons of hell and the devil himself will collapse in a heap at his word. And even when you step out like Peter in foolishness and make poor decisions, you belong to Christ. He'll protect you from ultimate harm. If you're a follower of Christ, you're safe. But you know, the safety that Jesus brought his followers that day went beyond just the protection from the dangers in the garden. The greatest safety that we gain from that night isn't the safety of Jesus putting all the soldiers on their backs. That's great. But the buckling of their knees was a small act of protection. The greatest act of protection that Jesus gave to us was when he put out his hands and allowed them to be bound. When he willingly gave himself up for us. It was that willing, voluntary act of giving himself over to drink the cup of God's wrath on our behalf that gives us ultimate safety on Judgment Day. Safety from the wrath of God. If we are in him. If we believe in him. If we trust. If we simply give our lives to him and in full confidence in him, entrust ourselves to him and follow him. We're not going to walk out of here today in silence and sorrow. Because we just studied about the crucifixion. I mean, we just studied we've just looked into the greatest expression of God's love ever. We have just spent time with the most profound self-sacrifice on our behalf. We've just witnessed the omnipotent power and sovereign control of Almighty God. We've just studied the infinite wisdom of God's perfect plan of salvation. We have nothing to be sad about. This is a time of rejoicing.